I'm going to read you three verses and ask you what they have in common in the way that we handle them. How do we handle these verses in the same way? If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. Do not resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. How do we handle those passages similarly? Typically, when we read or hear those passages, the first thing that we jump to is, here's what Jesus doesn't mean. We want to explain why he doesn't mean that you really have to take a slap in the face. You don't really have to believe that he didn't come to bring peace but a sword. You don't really have to rip your right eye out. You don't really have to do that. And so we want to explain why he doesn't mean, why he doesn't mean what he says. The reason I say that, so if you would like to turn to Matthew chapter 9, we're going to take our text from there, Matthew chapter 9. The reason I say that is because as I started to prepare a couple of weeks ago for a sermon on Matthew 9, 9 to 13, that's exactly what I did. I started preparing on Matthew 9 a sermon on why Jesus doesn't mean what it sounds like he means. And I caught myself, well, let's read it, and then we'll talk about it. Matthew 9 and verse 9. Matthew 9, 9. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. Then it happened that as Jesus was reclining at the table in the house, behold, many tax collectors and sinners came and were dining with Jesus and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why is your teacher eating with tax collectors and sinners?" But when Jesus heard this, he said, "It is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire compassion and not sacrifice. For I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners." For a good many days, I was preparing a sermon to tell you why Jesus didn't mean what he said when he quoted Hosea, who said, "I desire compassion and not sacrifice." And I didn't realize what I was doing until I went to get the PowerPoint ready and remembered that I had titled the sermon, "Christians Are Kind." The very title of the sermon is the fact that we are to be compassionate people. The title of the sermon isn't "Christians Are Sacrificers." The title of the sermon is "Christians Are Kind." And I thought, wait a minute, what am I doing? I'm talking about preparing for, describing only why Jesus didn't really mean that God doesn't desire sacrifice. And so when he said that, he was quoting, as I said, from Hosea. What did he mean? "I desire compassion and not sacrifice." We want to be careful when we go to the Bible and immediately, automatically, fervently focus on what it doesn't mean. Now, we got to know what he meant. Now, I'll just be honest with you. We're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about what he didn't mean. And I think we need to do that because our world hates organized religion. Our world hates church. Our world hates religious ritual. Our world hates everything that could be labeled organized religion. People say things all the time like, "I love Jesus, but I don't like church." Or, "I love Jesus, but I don't like Christians." Or, I'm spiritual, I'm just not religious. And we need to deal with that. We need to understand what Jesus was saying and what Jesus wasn't saying. Because as we talked about in our class this morning, it's just simply a fact that God did require sacrifice. He did desire it. When Jesus was living, and when Jesus said, "I desire compassion and not sacrifice," He may well have just come from the temple where He still smelled like smoke and had blood on Him from sacrifice. It is not true to say that when Jesus quoted that or when Hosea said it, that it meant that God never desired it. God directed them to do it. God said, "You will sacrifice to me," to the Jewish people. He said, He told them that, "You will do that. Not only do I want you to do it, I'm commanding you to do it." And as we saw this morning, Leviticus 1 through 9, He gave them all of these really strict regulations about exactly what they could do with what, when, with who, and how, and all of those things. And the Bible even says that God delighted. It says that when God smelled a sacrifice that was given correctly, remember the phrase that it uses, a soothing aroma. A soothing aroma. No, they didn't have pig pickings back then because they couldn't eat pig. But we do. And you know what a pig picking smells like. It's wonderful. It's soothing. It's enjoyable and pleasant. And that's what God is saying. God says, when you offer me a sacrifice, the way I want it done, and figuratively speaking, when I smell it, God said, that really makes me happy. Not only did God require it, He took delight in it. And when it was done wrong, He got really upset about that. When Nadab and Abihu offered a sacrifice with what the Bible calls strange fire, apparently they got it from the wrong place. What happened to them? Were they fined? Were they rebuked? Did they get a letter in the mail? Did they get a slap on the wrist? Or did God send fire from His presence and destroy them for getting sacrifice wrong? Malachi rebuked the people of his day and said, "You are robbing me because you're not bringing the right offerings." It is wrong to say that God never desired or cared anything about sacrifice. He is a strict and demanding God. You remember the account in Numbers 15 where there was a man who was gathering wood on the Sabbath? You remember that? The man was gathering wood on the Sabbath. Now, he was probably doing that because he needed to build a fire, or he was a woodworker and he needed to build something and make money. I doubt he just got up that Saturday morning and said, "I've got the day off. I don't want to go fishing and I don't want to play Scrabble with my family. I think I'll go out and gather some wood." He wasn't doing it for fun. There's no doubt that there's some important reason for gathering the wood. But when they found out about it, what happened? They stoned him to death. Because God is serious about His requirements. If there was ever anybody in the Bible that we could look at and say, you know, that guy had a good heart, it was Uzzah. When David decided to transport the ark the wrong kind of way, and Uzzah is walking along beside it, and the oxen stumbled, and the cart started to tip, and the ark was falling off, what did Uzzah do? He reached up and he stopped the... Listen, this is the Ark of the Covenant. And he stopped the Ark of the Covenant from hitting the ground. If ever a man had his heart in the right place, it was Uzzah. The problem was his hand was in the wrong place. And what did God do? He struck him dead. Because God cared about the rules that He created. He created them and He cared about people following them. It's wrong to say that God never cared anything in the world about sacrifice and about ritual. And yet, that's the culture we live in. John Shelby Spong, who is a very influential Christian leader of sorts, said this, "Christianity is, I believe, about expanded life, heightened consciousness, and achieving a new humanity, not about dogma and ritual." Now, just a little alert here. Anytime somebody is saying, telling me something about what is right and wrong or what God wants, and they insert the phrase, "I believe," that's a red flag to me. I don't care what he believes. I don't care what you believe. God doesn't care what we believe. Question is, what does God say? So is this true? Is Christianity not about ritual and dogma? Well, first we have to define terms. What is dogma? Dogma simply means a set of principles. Now listen carefully and see if you think God cares about this. Dogma is a set of principles laid down by an authority as incontrovertibly true. It is a set of principles that are given by an authority as being incontrovertibly true. Do you think God cares about that? Do you think that's part of serving God? Ritual is a series of actions performed according to a prescribed order. It's a series of actions that you do in a certain way. That's ritual. Does God care about dogma? Does God care about ritual? See, these things are easy to hate on. Everybody hates on dogma. And everybody hates somebody who's dogmatic. What I want to hear from somebody is for them to say, "Now, I'm not being dogmatic here." And what you'll almost never hear anybody say is, "I'm being dogmatic here. I'm going to be dogmatic." Nobody says that because it's off-putting. It's unpleasant. It's offensive when people are dogmatic. What we love more than anything is for somebody to say about somebody else, "You know that Charlie? That Charlie's such a great guy. I mean, he's a Christian, but he's not dogmatic." That's the ultimate compliment. He's a Christian, but he's not dogmatic. That's the ultimate compliment in our world. Charlie's fine. As long as Charlie's a Christian, nobody cares. As long as he's not dogmatic. Let Charlie start being dogmatic, now people care. Now people have a problem with that. Well, does God care about dogma? Does God care about ritual? Well, how would we know if he did? Well, we'd have to read it in the Bible. So let's take a look at the Apostle Paul. Did the Apostle Paul say anything about ritual? Did Paul say anything about ritual? Did Paul say anything about the ritual of singing? Or the ritual of prayer? Or the ritual of the Lord's Supper? Or the ritual of baptism? Or the ritual of the... Did Paul ever address those things? Well, I think that you know that he did. He told us how baptism works in Romans 6. He told us in 1 Corinthians 12 to 14 how the assembly is supposed to work and not work. He talked to us about singing in Ephesians 5 and Colossians 3. And he described to us how those things are supposed to happen. He talked to us about dogma. He talked to us about a set of principles given by an authority as incontrovertibly true. In passages like Galatians and Colossians and 1 Thessalonians, how serious was Paul about all of those things? Well, in Galatians chapter 1, he said, "If any man preaches to you a gospel contrary to that which we have preached to you, let him be accursed." You know what Paul said? Paul said, if anybody teaches differently than our dogma, they are to be accursed. Paul was dogmatic. Paul was dogmatic. And Paul said in 1 Corinthians 14, "The things that I write to you are the Lord's commandment. If anyone does not recognize these things, he is not recognized." Paul was talking in that passage about the assembly. And he said, If you don't understand that these assembly rules are binding, God does not recognize you. In other words, Paul said, if you don't follow the ritual I've given you, God does not recognize you. Paul cared about ritual. He said in 2 Thessalonians 3, we command you to obey our instruction in this letter. And if someone doesn't, then he is to be withdrawn from. Our culture hates organized religion. But dogma and ritual, according to the Bible, are required in order for a person to be right with God. So what's going on with this quote, I desire compassion and not sacrifice? Well, God, as Neil prayed in his prayer this morning, God cares about the heart. And God looks at the relationship between ritual and the heart in the United Kingdom period. With Saul and with David, God addressed the heart versus what they were doing. In the divided kingdom period in Judah, many times God had to correct His people for going to the temple but not living the truth. And even His people Israel, He had to address them as well. So God cares about the heart. And there's a certain balance that we have to get right with heart and ritual. So when Jesus was quoting this statement, we have to understand that He was using a figure of speech. When Jesus said, I desire compassion and not sacrifice, He was using three figures of speech. One of them is proverb. Jesus was being proverbial when He said, I desire compassion and not sacrifice. You know what a proverbial statement is. It's a statement that's generally true, but cannot be pressed to be true every single time. A couple of examples. Proverbs 10:27. Fear of the Lord prolongs life, but the years of the wicked will be shortened. Fear of the Lord prolongs life, but the years of the wicked will be shortened. How old was Jesus when He died? He was 33. Did He fear the Lord? Was His life long? To everybody's understanding, dying at 33 is dying young. This is a proverbial statement. It doesn't always hold true. Another proverbial statement, when a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, He makes even his enemies be at peace with him. When you do the right thing, even people who hate you will love you eventually. What about Jesus? It didn't work for Jesus. Those are proverbial statements. And when Jesus says, I desire compassion and not sacrifice, He's not talking in absolute terms. He's using a proverb. Jesus is also using another figure of speech, hyperbole or exaggeration. Jesus is using a hyperbolic statement that focuses all on one thing to the exclusion of another. For instance, Jesus said, He who comes to me and does not hate his own father, mother, wife, children, brothers, and sisters is not worthy of me. So Jesus in that statement is using exaggeration. He says, if you come to me, it's either me or family. It's me or mom. You pick. You can't have both. It's me or kids. You pick. But you can't have... He's not saying that. We understand that He's speaking in an exaggerated way in order to make a point about priority. Finally, Jesus is using a figure of speech called ellipsis. This is where words are left out. Words are left out, but they're understood to be there. I'll give you an example. Paul said, in talking about the sexual relationship in marriage, he said that the wife does not have authority over her own body. And that's not an absolute statement. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. That's not absolute. There's some words left out in that, right? Because it's not true that she never has authority over her own body. But there are some words left out. The statement means the wife in that situation does not have complete authority over her body. But there are some words that are left out. And Jesus, in quoting this passage, is leaving a word out. Where God is saying, I desire compassion and not only sacrifice. So Jesus is being figurative here. But what he's emphasizing is the necessity for his people to be people of kindness. And we'll talk about what that looks like in just a moment. First of all, next week, Lord willing, this is the start of a brief new series, Characteristics of Christians. We're talking today about kindness. Next week, we'll talk about how Christians are supposed to live life together. So we'll hit that next week out of Acts chapter 2. But for now, I want to give you a few takeaways from what Jesus says in this passage. First of all, there's the necessity of distinguishing between a divinely mandated and a man-made ritual. We have to distinguish between a divinely mandated and a human ritual when we're deciding exactly what it is that we have to do. If man has created a ritual, it is not automatically binding. Now, I would hesitate to say that it's never binding. I got into a little disagreement with a friend of mine the other day. I had made the statement in a video that the Sunday evening service is binding. I made the statement that being at the Sunday evening service is binding on Christians. I believe that it is. By the way, did you notice I just said I believe? So there's a red flag, just so you know. I'll point it out. I don't care. Right? So just be careful with what I'm saying here. But I believe that it is. And he said, well, Sunday night can't be binding because people made that up. This is something we do. It's a man-made trick. It's a man-made thing. It can't be binding. But I said to him, Hebrews chapter 10 says, do not forsake the assembling of the saints together. So if we do that at 9:30, and we do that at 10:30, and we do that at 6 o'clock, if the saints are assembling, then it is our obligation to be there. That's how I understand that. I understand that the Sunday night service is something that people have decided to do. I get that. But just because people do it that way doesn't make it automatically not important. A lot of times we blow stuff off with that. Well, that's how we've always done it. Well, sometimes that matters. But we have to distinguish between the two. We have to understand, as we've seen this morning, that both ritual and compassion are essential. They're not mutually exclusive. It's not that you say, okay, I'm going to be somebody who loves people, so I don't have to go to church. I'm going to be somebody who loves people, so I'm not going to worry about the ritual of baptism. I'm going to treat other people well, so I'm not going to worry about taking the Lord's Supper and singing, because I love people. It's not either or. Both ritual and compassion are essential. We also need to understand that ritual is a form of compassion. Ritual is a form of compassion. Church is ritual, but it is a compassionate form of ritual. When we come together, the things that we do are helpful to one another. When we come together, we get comfort and strength and encouragement. Ritual is a form of compassion. We also need to understand that ritual without compassion is an abomination. Ritual without compassion is an abomination. We are not allowed to do church instead of loving other people. In other words, we don't get to check the church box and then not worry about the way that we live day to day. We don't get to come to church, or not come to church rather, come to church and then not be what we're supposed to be outside. Many years ago, I had a friend who was in church on Sunday evening, and his house caught on fire and it was burning to the ground. And while they were having church, a neighbor drove to the church, back before cell phones, a neighbor drove to the church building and interrupted the service and said, "Your house is on fire." And so the church immediately stopped the service. They all jumped in their cars and drove over to see what they could do. Can you imagine if they would have said, "Hang on a second. We're having church here. You can't just drop everything. Go try to help somebody. We're having church, man. Wait till 7 o'clock when we're done and we've dismissed the Lord with a closing prayer, and then we'll drive over there." Or they immediately stop church, as they should have done. Because you cannot just do church and not help other people. You can't do church and not love each other at church. Paul said to the Corinthians, when you go to church, you're worse off than before you went. Can you imagine a worse thing to be said about the way you do church? He said, you come together not for the better but for the worse. When you're done having church, you are worse off. And the reason was because they did not love each other. That's why. They didn't love each other. And their church service made things worse. Did you know it's possible to do the things that God commands to the T and still be dead wrong? I was preaching somewhere one time and I made the point in a sermon that Jesus said, if there's a problem between you and another Christian, you must make it right immediately. Don't wait. It must be done immediately. When I got done preaching, a woman went forward. I was visiting somewhere, so I went to your contractually obligated place at the back as the visiting preacher, any preacher. So I went to the back, and the local preacher sat down to hear her issue. So what she said she was doing what I had said. She was taking, because the problem was between her and the preacher. Can you imagine anybody having a problem with a preacher? I know, insane. But her problem was with him. And so what she was doing was literally doing exactly what I had just said. Except she was using that opportunity to blame the preacher for the entire situation and tell him how wrong he was. And he needed to fix it. She did the right thing, but she did it the wrong way. And entirely for the wrong reason. And we can do that. It's possible. When ritual and compassion conflict, compassion wins. When ritual and compassion conflict, compassion wins. We know this from Matthew 12. When David and his companions were hungry, they went to the tabernacle. It's the only place they felt safe going. They said to the priest, Abiathar, "Do you have any food here?" And he said, "No. The only thing I've got is what? The only thing I have is the bread that's holy, that only a priest can eat. But," he said, "here, take it, because you're starving." And he ate, and it was okay. When ritual and compassion conflict, when it's a choice between I'm going to keep this ritual, or I'm going to save a life, or serve a need, the need wins out. Compassion wins. This is what Jesus is talking to us about in that passage. So when we look at that passage, we're going to sing this song in just a moment. If you have a book and want to turn to it, 526 is the number we're going to sing the song. It will be on the PowerPoint, but if you care to use a book, it's number 526, and you're welcome to do that. Unfortunately, what Jesus said needs to be unpacked in our culture. It would be great if we could simply read what Jesus said and just let it stand and say, "Well, I understand that. That God cares about the heart. God is looking for me to love my brother, my sister, or other people. God is looking for love. God wants me to love. It's important that I love. But it's also important that I do the other things as well. It would be great if we just, but we don't. In our culture, we have to understand. Because our culture hates church. Our culture hates dogmatic. Our culture hates ritual. And the Bible says that dogma and ritual and kindness all go together. They are all required. They're all important. And so that's a lot to think about. And as we sing the song of invitation, it's a good time to think about all of that. What is my relationship to God? What is the status of my heart before God? Where do I stand with Him? Where do I stand with His people? Where do I stand with people I work with, people I live around, people in my family? What is my relationship to them? How do I treat them? What is my relationship to the church? What is my heart life, my thought life? What are my actions like? A lot to think about. And that's the purpose of the invitation song, to give us a moment to think about all of those things. And while you're doing that, if you decide that there's something that you need to make right, maybe it's something private and personal, take care of it that way. Maybe it's something that you need help with, and this is why we give this opportunity. As we're singing, if you decide there's something you need help with, we'd love to talk to you privately after church. We'll sit down and meet with you. We'll get a Bible out. We'll talk about what the Bible says. Or if you know what you need to do, we'll help you with that. Whatever the case, we'd love to speak with you privately after church. Or you can come forward and take a seat on the front as we stand and sing this song together.